I grabbed Will Solace from the Apollo cabin and told the rest of his siblings to keep searching for Michael Yu. We borrowed a Yamaha FZ1 from a sleeping biker and drove to the Plaza Hotel at speeds that would have given my mom a heart attack.
Welcome to Floor 600. This is a podcast for two friends, Natalie
and Quinn.
Read the Percy Jackson and the Olympian series by Rick Riordan. We are now reading the last book of the series, The Last Olympian.
Uh-oh. In this episode, we're reading chapters 12 through 13.
12 and 13.
What? I forgot for a second, even though I just read it.
Yes, we are, because these chapters are too long. They're not even longer than any normal chapters. This book is like the same length as the other books, for the most part, but
it just feels like it's going to take us so long to get through.
It's because they're so dense. Like, there's a lot happening, and there's a lot of things being, like, wrapped up.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of stuff happening at every moment.
Yeah. And everything that happens has, like, 10 layers to it, so it's, like...
Mm-hmm. It's very exciting and nerve-wracking. But before we get into that, let's get into Feel Famous with us.
Yes. So
we feel famous today.
Yes, all the time. We are still holding out for baby centaur name suggestions. Yeah. And maybe you should post it on Insta. Maybe people haven't seen it.
I know. I keep meaning to, and then it just disappears from my mind. So I'll do that.
Okay. So Elliot has suggested two names for the baby centaur. Elliot's beating all of you guys.
Yeah, so, Elliot for the win. He's probably going to get it just because he offered the name.
Yeah. So from Elliot, we have Baby Chiron and Coach. Samuel,
I like Coach.
Yeah, that's a good one. Samuel suggested Diego, and Diego suggested Flopsy.
And by mentioning Samuel and Diego... We should say that we were on an episode of the Half-Blood Report that's
yes.
hosted by Samuel and Diego.
Yes, it was really fun. It was a good laugh. So everybody should go over to their YouTube channel and check that out. I don't know if they host anywhere else.
No, it's on, if you look it up on Spotify, anywhere you get podcasts. And and I'm sorry to say, but we did make one of their longest episodes. So
yes.
We have that habit.
Samuel said that they only have three episodes that are longer than 40 minutes, and it's like, we are one of those. And he's like, yes.
I thought that when we finished, I was like, I wonder if they'll edit this down to 30 minutes, but how would that be possible? We spent 30 minutes doing a quiz.
Yes. Yeah, so definitely go check that out and have a laugh and support our friends Samuel and Diego.
Yeah, it was really, really fun.
It was really fun. And also, another thing that is super fun and that makes me feel famous every time I see it, is the damn meme page on Twitter. If you're on Twitter, it's damn in like Percy Jackson damn, you know, the damn meme page. Very funny memes about us and other PJO podcasters all together, and it makes me smile. So you should go support him on that.
Yeah, Natalie, I guess I'm not on Twitter, so Natalie will just share those with me every once in a while.
So
and it's
fun.
Just like, yes, I love it.
I love the one that he did that's like us sitting in the chairs and then the little dog or the little guy, and it's like Quinn, Natalie, Quinn's dogs.
And then he's like, I can't tell the difference between the two of them speaking, but at the same time they sound completely different, and it's true.
That was hilarious. Anyway, those memes really make me smile, so. Thanks, Robert, for making memes.
Yeah, at damn meme page.
Yes.
So, go for it.
Fun fact that's making me feel famous, actually, that I just remembered. We have 15,000 downloads now. Isn't
That's
that a huge
crazy.
Number?
Crazy.
I know.
Imagine that. That means that we've talked to 15,000 different people. No.
Not necessarily, because
no.
Some people listen to every one of our episodes.
All right. So we've talked to, I don't know, a crazy amount of people for an insane amount of time.
Right. So thank you for 15,100 downloads.
Yes.
I don't know why I keep doing the arm dance today. It's just my thing, apparently.
Well, you're in a square. You can only do so much.
True. All right. So.
Are you ready for this? Are you ready to get in deep?
No.
I know. No one is. No one ever is. Chapter 12. Rachel makes a bad deal.
I gave that 4 stars.
I once again lost my spot. I gave that 5 stars.
Nice.
Because, you read it, and you're just immediately, like, bad feelings. Like,
yes.
So many bad deals that one can make. And I wrote down in my, in my notes, I was like, Supernatural has turned me against deals, so deals are never good.
That's very true, actually. If it involves a deal, good or bad, I'm hesitant about it. But then I was like, well, how is Rachel going to get involved in this again? Because she's been kind of peripheral this whole time.
Yeah, she's in the Virgin Islands right now, living it up on the beach.
I want to see Rachel come back. I want to know how she makes a deal. And I just like Rachel, I guess.
And then in the first sentence, we get Will Solace.
Yes. And,
oh, it's so exciting.
I read that, and after I read for the last episode, I read the first page of this chapter, and I was like, oh, we got Will Solace in this book? I forgot about him.
It's so exciting.
Yeah. Now that, when the first time you read this, it's just like, oh, this is just another random demigod, you know? But then later on, he's given new context.
So it means so much more when you know later on. And even just if you look on whatever, the fandom, there is so much Will and Nico art.
Yeah.
You can't avoid it. You have to know that this is a thing.
Yeah. And also you can't avoid spoilers, which is really annoying.
Yeah.
It's like, please mark your stuff as spoilers.
But then, they've been out for so long.
I don't care. It would be,
marking something that says Voldemort's the bad guy as a spoiler.
Would not be that bad. All I'm saying is I haven't read the Heroes of Olympus series, and I get spoilers all the time, and honestly, I'll probably forget all of them by the time we start reading, but still. It's I want to be present, but I don't want spoilers.
I don't mind spoilers, because I like being able to be like, ooh, I think this is what happens.
All right, anyway, bringing it back.
Yep, back.
So, yes, in this chapter, Percy steals a Yamaha FZ1, apparently it's a motorcycle, and brings Will Solace with him to the Plaza, which is this old-fashioned hotel on the southeast corner of Central Park. So if you remember the map, it was north of the Empire State Building. It says on the southeast corner. No, southeast corner. And it's looks over Central Park, I guess, the terrace thing. Yeah.
So I added some information in your notes because in the book, Percy sort of just casually mentions the Plaza Hotel and then the Beatles and Alfred Hitchcock. And I wanted to give some context to why that is. So the Plaza Hotel is a super historic, just quintessential New York hotel, I guess.
Oh.
And the Beatles connection is they stayed at the Plaza in 1964 during their first visit to the U.S. And And there is footage of the Plaza during the Beatles visit. And it is crazy. The place was mobbed. People teenage girls were trying to break in order to sneak into John Lennon's bathroom. It's craziness.
Yikes.
1960s teens were just as crazy as 2020 people in general.
I believe it. That's so scary.
And the Alfred Hitchcock connection is So I have not seen this movie, unfortunately. I've rented it multiple times. I've just never watched it. In the film North by Northwest, directed by Alfred Hitchcock, that was the first time the Plaza was prominently featured on the big screen. The Plaza was used twice during the film. First, in the beginning, when Roger Thornhill, who is by Cary Grant, is abducted from the Oak Bar. And then later in the movie, when he's like searching a hotel room. But what's sort of fun fact is that the Oak Bar and the hotel room were not actually in the Plaza. Those were just sets that they built. And what? Then, but the Plaza was featured as like, just like the lobby shots and exterior shots, but they did like their actual like scenes are just sets.
Why didn't they just use the existing place? Why'd they build a set?
Because
the hotel were like, I don't want you using my stuff. What if you break it?
Maybe.
It's so strange. You would think they would have been able to like save the money and the trouble of building a whole set for that.
One would think.
Because this hotel has to have a bar in it, right? It was built in the 1960s.
Yes, the Oak Bar still exists.
So strange. But it is cool that it's like, because I feel like now that we're in Manhattan and Rick is pointing out all these like places, you know, the streets and like the hotel and the park and stuff, it's like, okay, these things have some context, but I don't know what it is because I've never been to New York City.
I know. And for me, at least, it helps me when I like picture movies because that's how you see a lot of different cities when you don't actually get to visit them. It's like, oh, so this was seen in this movie.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm trying to see what other movies it was in so I can get, oh, Home Alone 2. Duh. Home Alone 2 is at the Plaza.
Really?
Yeah. I knew that. I was like, sort of like, I feel like that was buzzing in my head. But the Plaza is where Kevin McAllister stays.
Wow.
Home Alone 2. It was also in Bride Wars, the 2013 Great Gatsby, Sleepless in Seattle, a Woody Allen movie.
The Plaza, Seattle.
The Way We Were, sorry, if you wanted the titles. And The Front, if you wanted the titles.
So it's actually, like, really well known, and I was just like...
Yeah, it's a very famous building.
I don't know what that is.
And Annabeth is bleeding in one of the rooms.
Yes.
Let's picture her in... Annabeth is bleeding in Kevin McAllister's suite, the presidential suite where he sleeps in. But yeah, so Annabeth is now bleeding in Kevin McAllister's suite, and it's scary.
Yeah. So there's a bronze statue at the door, and while Percy and Will are driving through the city, Percy notices that there are a lot of pedestals where the statues used to stand that are empty now. So he's like, I don't know if this is working out for us or not, but we shall see. So... there's one of the bronze statues is at the door of the Plaza Hotel, and she's like, oh, I guess you want me to watch that bike now, too. And he's like, are you supposed to be Demeter? The statue is just wearing, like, a skirt, and she has, like, a bowl of fruit, and she's standing in a bowl and stuff. And Percy's like, are you supposed to be Demeter? So she's like, no, and she throws a bronze apple at him. And she's like, I am Pomona, the Roman goddess of plenty. And if you cared about the minor gods and goddesses, you wouldn't be fighting this war. And Percy's just like, watch the bike, and goes inside with Will. Oh, and she's like, three cheers for Morpheus, and heck it, I say. And he's like, no. So they just go inside. And they find that the demigods and hunters have taken over, like, the top two floors of the hotel. And they're just, like, eating from the mini bar. They're using the curtains as bandages. There are timber wolves drinking out of the toilets. Like, they're...
I love that.
I know. It's really funny. And Jake Mason, who is the new head of the Hephaestus cabin, tries to talk to Percy. And he's like, hey, Percy, mm-hmm. we're getting reports. And Percy's like, no. and pushes him out of the way, essentially, and heads straight out onto the terrace to find Annabeth.
So Harrison's got different priorities.
Yes, he's like, I have to handle something else first. And so Annabeth is out there lying on a lounge chair, and Percy's like, I wish I could appreciate this amazing view from this terrace right now, but I cannot because Annabeth is dying. So there's like a bunch of Athena kids out there with her, and like Selena's with her, and she's covered in blankets, but she's still like shivering. So Will pushes through her and realizes that there was poison on Ethan's dagger. So not only does she have like a gaping wound, but it's poisoned. And luckily Will is like, oh, it hasn't spread that much yet. So he's like, somebody hand me some nectar. So he like bathes the wounded nectar, bandages it, and speaks a prayer to Apollo over it in ancient Greek. But just like Nico and Percy, using his powers strains Will. So he's like all tired and stuff after.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm so glad that Rick like carries that through with people, you know, because it would be weird if Percy was the only one who got tired after using his powers.
It's a nice consistency that, like, yeah, these kids have amazing powers, but just because they have it doesn't mean that they have, like, unlimited powers.
Right.
There are limits.
Exactly. So Will is like, all right, we need to go down to the Duane Reade down the street, which apparently is just an old chain of pharmacies that's, like, getting bought out by Walgreens, which seems kind of sad.
What?
And he's like, Will's like, just
oh, you looked them up?
Yeah. I was like, what is Duane Reade? And I looked it up, and it was like, Duane Reade, Walgreens. And then there are articles that was like, Duane Reade, the pharmacy chain, is disappearing, leaving some locals heartbroken. And I was like, aw. They like their Duane Reades here, there in New York City. And Will's like, just leave money or drachmas or whatever you have to pay for the supplies. It's like, normally I wouldn't steal. And Travis is like, I would. And Will just glares at him like, no. But I'm like, okay, Will. You're stealing bandages and like Neosporin. If ever there's a time to steal, okay. I think this is okay. This is that time.
Bring up Will and Travis later, but is there something there?
Oh my god. No, he glares at him.
Maybe it's like a come on, man, we've talked about it before.
Oh my god.
And Travis is just like, I know what you need. I'll steal it for you. I know that, like, this is what I'm good at. I show my love through theft.
There's even less there than there is between Ethan and Luke. No.
Well, this is our only interaction. We don't know.
Oh, my goodness.
I like to think maybe that was, like, maybe they were just flirting a little bit.
I don't get it. You know? I don't get that one. New controversial ships here on every episode of Floor 600. I. You know what?
Will ships and Travis. He steals his heart.
My God. Anyway, back to the terrace with Selena and Annabeth and Percy. Selena is like taking care of Annabeth, and she's like, she feels guilty for some reason that we don't know. Really, she's just like, this is my fault. If I had been a better camper, if I were a better fighter, this wouldn't have happened, blah blah blah. And Percy and Annabeth are like, that literally makes no sense. You're a great camper, you make friends with everyone, you're the best Pegasus rider we have. Like, how could this possibly be your fault, you know? And Percy's like, if if I ever find the spy who cost Beckendorf his life, I will make him into a chew toy for my dog. And it's like, he angry.
Yeah. And you think Mrs. O'Leary would like that?
I don't know, because she is a hellhound.
Yeah, that's true.
It'd just be appealing to her nature.
Mm-hmm. I know my dogs the other day found, or not the other day, yesterday, massacred a whole bunch of bunnies, so.
Oh. See, yeah. We don't know.
Yeah, it's in their nature sometimes.
Percy tries to make Selena feel better about her life by telling her all these nice things, and he's like, and if anyone who can make friends with Clarice has talent, and Selena's like, oh, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the Pegasus and fly back to camp and convince Clarice to come to Manhattan and help us fight this war. And Percy's like, I don't know about that. And Annabeth's like, we need all the help we can get. Let her go. So Percy gives his blessing to do this, and Selena jumps up and hugs him, and then she's like, oh, Annabeth's right there, and like pushes him away and like pulls back. I'm like, oh my god, everybody knows what's happening with Percy and Annabeth. Nobody wants to admit it, or they don't want to admit it, I guess. So Percy like kneels down next to Annabeth, and Annabeth's like, you look cute when you're concerned, or you look cute when you're worried. And he's like, what? And she's like, your eyebrows get all scrunched up in the middle.
I love this moment. It's so cute.
You know, it's so sweet. And it's like, I don't know, it's just this really showing her, like, actually being, like, showing affection for him instead of just, like, pretending she's, A, pretending she doesn't have any affection for him, or B, actively pushing him away, which is what she's been doing up until this point.
Yeah. And this is the first real moment that we've seen, like, vulnerability from her. Like, up until now, she's always sort of just been that badass Annabeth Chase with a sword and a laptop, or not a sword, a knife and a dagger and a laptop. And kicking butts, taking names. And now she's the one who needs help.
Yeah.
And Percy can't, is it the one who can help her?
I mean, he brought Will.
Yeah. He's the one who can assist the person that are actually doing the helping.
So Annabeth is like, or Percy's like, why would you take that knife from me? Like, that was dangerous. He could have killed you. And Annabeth's like, you would have done the same for me. And he's...
It's so true.
Yeah. Percy's just like... You got me there. So he's like, did you know about my mortal spot being in my back? And she's like, no. And she's like, where is it? So he like shows her, and she like puts her hand on his back, and he's like, freaks out a little bit.
Sensitive spot.
Yeah. And it's like, it says that his entire body feels like 1,000 volts of electricity. And even after she moves her hand, he continues to hold it. It's like, oh, they're so sweet. And they just kind of sit together for a while longer. And Percy notices that there's like a plume of smoke in the distance, which means that somebody probably left the oven on or something. And now New York is going to be set on fire, as well as being taken over by monsters. So that's fun. I just thought of Percy and Sally and Paul being asleep in the city somewhere. Like, what if they were cooking and they left the stove on?
Sally's burning the blue cookies.
Annabeth tells Percy what Hermes meant when he said that Annabeth could have saved Luke. And she's like, it's been bothering me for a while. And Percy's like, you don't have to tell me. And she's like, I want to. So, Annabeth's big news is this. Last summer, before Luke went into the labyrinth, and before, obviously, he became Cronus's host, Luke came to visit Annabeth at her home in San Francisco under a flag of truce. And Luke said that he wanted to run away and, like, try to escape Cronus. But Annabeth didn't believe him because... Why would she? Yeah. After everything. And she thinks it's just another trick. So Luke is like, well, you might as well just fight me right now. because this is the last chance you're ever going to get. And she's like, no. She says to Percy, she kind of regrets, like, not fighting him. But what was she going to do, you know? It's Luke. He's coming to her under a flag of truce. And what's she going to do, like, pull out the knife that he gave her and stab him? No. And even if that had happened, it wouldn't have stopped Kronos from finding somebody else.
Yeah. It would have been Ethan instead.
Exactly. No, seriously, it probably would have been. So it's like, she kind of feels bad. She's like, oh, I could have prevented this war. It's like, no, this war is going to happen anyway.
Yeah.
It's
been prophesied.
Exactly. Like, maybe she could have stopped Luke from becoming Kronos' host, but what difference?
Not much else. Yeah. Yeah. But, so, is it just me? Does it seem like they sort of present this moment as this is the decision that Janus was talking about in the labyrinth? Or is that decision still to come?
It kind of feels like it. Because Luke told Annabeth that Kronos would use him as a stepping stone to the next level. So it's like,
but he said that before the labyrinth.
Exactly. So the way Rick wrote this, it's like, was her choice to fight Luke or not? But then Percy remembers afterward that Janus was like, oh, you still have your choice. And Hera said something to her about it too, when they're in the labyrinth. So it's like,
so no, it's still right, going
the
down.
Same choice. Yeah. It's not the choice everybody was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But then I also kind of thought that Annabeth's choice was whether or not to join the Hunters, you know?
Oh, yeah. But so, that would be still a decision left to come. Because whatever decision that Janus was talking about happens in this book, right? Happens after the Battle of the Labyrinth. Has to. So it can't be when Luke came and visited her before the Labyrinth.
Yeah, but your question was, is it presented as if that was the choice? And my answer to that was yes.
Yes. I read that and I was like, wait, I'm really confused now. This isn't right, is it?
Yeah, and Percy has the same thought. He's like, there's still something. And he remembers what Pan said about her still having a role to play as well. So he's like, well, what role is it? What's the choice? I need to know.
We only have half of a book left. We have to know.
But before Percy can ask her about all of this, Connor Stoll comes out onto the terrace and tells Percy that Mrs. O'Leary has come back with Grover. Yay,
and
Grover.
His brother Travis and Will are off in the woods making out.
You know what ship we haven't talked about that I see on the fandom groups? Is Selena and Clarice.
You know what? I have seen that ship, and I just don't see that ship. Selena is definitely in love with Charles. Like, yes. You can't... Sorry. No. Selena is not going to be with anybody other than Charles. I could see maybe some kind of relationship blooming if Charles wasn't in the picture. But really, I just see them as, like, they're the best friends. Like,
yeah.
Clarice is the girlfriend, and Selena's there for her. So I think this is it's the only time we see Clarice have a friend.
Yeah.
So
that's Chris Rodriguez.
Mm-hmm. And Chris is there for other purposes.
Yeah.
He fulfills other needs.
Yeah. But no, I agree. Like, you know how much I would love for that to be a real canon ship. But I do not see it at all. Like, why can't they just be really good friends? They each have boyfriends.
I know.
Yeah. And, like, sure, they could be bi or whatever. But I just do not see it.
Mm-mm. I think it's just, like, a good female friendship that we need to see in this movie. Or in this book. Or whatever it is anymore.
Selena's not even in those trash movies, Quinn.
No, she isn't. But she's not even, she's barely in the first book, so.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know, man. I tried to see it, and I just can't.
I know, you try and keep an open mind with some of these ships, but some of them, it's just like, my mind can't open that far.
My mind is not open enough. So, this episode is like, we're starting here, and we're going, we're only like 20 minutes in.
I know. There's a lot to talk about for this, okay?
Yeah. There is. So Grover is back. He's at the Plaza Hotel. Woohoo, Grover. And he's the Demeter cabin has made food for everyone using like the kitchen supplies in the hotel. But Grover is eating the furniture, and Percy like remembers that this is a nervous habit of his, which I thought was really cute. And because Grover's like, you know, I eat furniture when I get, and Percy's like, nervous. Yeah, I know. What's the story here? So Grover tells Percy that he's mobilized most of the nature spirits in the city, but some of them wouldn't listen to him, like they wouldn't fight or whatever. So Grover and the spirits who would listen to him have been covering Uptown, but a dozen wood nymphs died when a baby dragon showed up, so yikes, and hellhounds took out a bunch of them, and 20 satyrs died at Fort Washington, which is apparently half of Grover's kinsmen.
Yeah.
Which is just wild. And Talia shows up while Grover's talking, giving his report, and she chimes in and she tells Percy that Kronos' army is still gathering at every bridge. And she saw, remember back when Percy had that dream about Mount Othrys and Nico was there and the two titans were there talking? The gold
one. Long time ago, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that.
The gold one. The gold guy is there in Manhattan, which is not good.
No. Whenever a big glowing guy that is angry at you shows up, be scared.
Yes. So Percy's like, can I have some good news, please? And Talia's like, well, my best trappers sealed off all the subway tunnels in Manhattan. Nice. And she thinks that Kronos needs time to regenerate after every battle to, like, you know, restore his powers. Mm-hmm. Because it's taking a lot out of him to slow down time around, you know, the entirety of Manhattan. Which, honestly, would be pretty tiring, even for a Titan, I guess. And the gods are still off fighting Typhon, and he's going to be in Manhattan at least by the day after tomorrow. Like, they're not making any progress here.
So what is it? The Titans are taking basically the daytime off, and then they would fight during the at night?
I guess so.
I that's basically like a reverse of like, I guess, more traditional ancient warfare, being like you would fight during the day and then you would not fight during the night, and everyone would gather the dead and the injured and then regroup for the morning to charge at each other again. So
yeah, that's
it's
true.
Just the sort of reverse of that.
Yeah, Talia's like, also it seems like the enemy is waiting for tonight to attack. Kronos needs time to regenerate after each fight. He's still not comfortable with his new form. It's taking a lot of his power to slow time around the city. So, and then Grover says most of his forces are more powerful at night too, but they'll be back after sundown.
Yeah.
So they get the power at the nighttime. And Jake Mason has been like there listening to all of this, and Percy like kind of forgets that he's there for a second. But Jake has been using the sunlight shield that Annabeth brought to keep an eye on Kronos and his army. And he points out that Kronos knew exactly where to send his troops. Like, he knew where their weakest points were. He's like, he knew where you were going and where we were going and how, you know, this is bad. And Percy's like, oh, it's because of the spy. It must be. And Tali's like, what spy?
This is the first time hearing of it. Thank you.
Yeah. So Percy explains it, and she's like, that's not good. He's like, nope. But Jake's like,
nope, but we don't have time to address it now, so yeah. Move on.
And Jake's like, it could be literally anybody because they were all gathered there at the, you know, when Percy was telling them where to go, they were all there. So it could be literally anybody. But like you said, Percy's like, we can't obsess over this. We just have to keep going or we'll just lose everything.
Yeah.
Oh boy. This is a really sad part. So Talia tells Percy to go lie down and get some rest, and he's tired enough that he actually does it. He dreams about Nico D'Angelo.
Dream sequence.
Yay.
Digging a hole. Natalie's favorite part.
Yay, two more dream sequences. But Percy dreams about Nico digging a hole in the gardens of Hades and pouring a glass full of wine into the hole to summon the spirit of his mother, Maria D'Angelo. And instead of Maria appearing, Bianca appears. And she tells Nico that he is forbidden from seeing Maria. And Bianca's literally been dead for 2 years, and she's still trying to boss Nico around. And Nico's like, I'm not the same as I used to be, which is so sad. He's still only like 12 years old. And he's like, I'm not the same as I used to be, Bianca. It's like, you're still a child.
And yet he has changed so very much.
Yep. So he waves Bianca away and summons Maria again. But instead of just seeing her spirit in the same way that he sees Bianca, he sees like scenes playing out in the mist in front of him. So the first scene is Hades and Maria sitting on a couch in a hotel talking about something while Nico and Bianca as children like play out in the lobby. So he's seeing the scene that happened, what, 60 years ago, 70 years ago?
Yeah.
And Maria has this Italian accent and she's dressed all in black like she's this 1940s movie star.
She just sounds fabulous.
She really does. But she's arguing with Hades, who's telling her, like, he has to bring them all to the underworld to keep them safe, because this is around the time when, like, they first entered that agreement not to have children together, or not to have any more demigod children, not to have children together. Hades is arguing with Maria, telling her that he has to bring her and the children to the underworld to keep the children safe, because Zeus has ordered Hades to turn Nico and Bianca over to Camp Half-Blood for proper training. But Hades doesn't trust Zeus to not just, like, smite them as soon as they're out of Hades' sight.
I don't trust Zeus to not just smite them.
Right. And this is, like, happening in the 40s, so it's the time that Zeus and Poseidon are angry at Hades for his demigod children causing havoc.
For Hitler.
Yeah. And they've agreed not to have any more demigod children. So Hades is, like, afraid of losing Maria and Nico and Bianca. And Maria's like, it's fine. They're children. He wouldn't hurt children. Blah, blah, blah. I'm not
has
going to the underworld.
Has she read Greek mythology?
I know. It's like, has she listened to Hades at all? No.
Nope.
She refuses to allow them to go to the underworld based on blind faith that Zeus won't smite them when he obviously does not care.
I know. Can't blame Maria, though. Can't blame Maria.
No. There's only one person to blame for this.
There's only one god to blame for it.
Yes. So Maria's like, it's okay, Hades. I love you. You're the best. I love you so much. We'll be safe. And I'm going to go get my purse. So she, like, walks away. And there's, like, this mysterious force explodes the entire hotel, killing everyone except Hades, obviously, and the children, who only survive because he has the presence of mind to throw this, like, black wall of energy over them. Mm-hmm. Literally destroys the entire hotel, including Maria.
Three mortals. And he only got one of them.
Yeah. It's insane. He wanted Nico and Bianca dead so bad, he just destroyed the whole place. Mm-hmm. Zeus! So, Hades, like, is holding Maria, and Nico and Bianca are just like, what just happened? Kind of a situation. So the Fury Electo shows up and she's like, what do you want me to do, essentially? And Hades tells her to take Nico and Bianca and bathe their memories clean in the river. Lethe?
Yeah.
In the Lethe. And then take them to the Lotus Hotel. And he's like, Zeus will not harm them there. So this is like the only safe place besides the underworld. And he probably just is trying to like respect Maria's wishes, you know?
Mm-hmm. But he doesn't. He doesn't respect her wishes at all because she's just like, I don't want my kids to go to this casino. I don't want my kids to go to the underworld. I want to stay with my kids. And then immediately she dies. And yeah, he doesn't bring the kids to the underworld, but he brings them to that hotel that she said that she didn't want them to go to. And yeah. Guess where Nico is now? He's in the underworld.
Yeah. It's just like he couldn't bring them to the underworld because she didn't want them there, but he can't take care of them himself. So it's like they're not going to be safe anywhere except the casino.
Mm-hmm.
It's really sad.
It is.
So Electo takes Maria's body and the kids away, and Hades is just, you know, grief stricken. And then this girl shows up. And she's wearing this multicolored dress, and she's talking to Hades about how he can't bring Maria back for the dead. And she's like, you of all people should know that that is not a good idea. And he's like, shut up. This is your fault. It's your stupid prophecy that set Zeus against my kids. I'm not allowed to have any more kids. I lost the woman I love. This is all your fault.
Now I only have my wife.
Yeah. Now I only have the woman I'm married to. Lame.
The goddess I'm married to.
Yeah. And, I guess it's important to say that this is the Oracle of Delphi. The girl. Mm-hmm. The girl, I guess, whose body hosts the Oracle of Delphi.
Yeah.
And she's like, I don't write the future. I just report it. Like, it's not my fault. All I do is
think it's interesting that this girl is already wearing like a multicolored hippie dress, even though it's the 1940s.
Yeah.
She's very ahead of the curve. I guess that's why she's the Oracle.
True. But it's like, what, did she just like continuously wear that tie-dye dress? Like she never wore anything else?
Maybe she got a prophecy that said, hey, in the 1960s, guess what's going to be great? Rainbow color, long hair. It's gonna be great. And she's just like, that is where I should be. So she start dressing up as a 1960s like hippie girl in the 1940s. She was
never wore anything.
Maybe she
else.
Started the trend.
Yeah, there you go. She's like, I shall wear a tie-dye dress every day for the rest of my miserable life because.
So let's go.
Huh? You froze.
Oh, sorry. You were frozen too, so I was responding to froze.
Did you hear what I said about her wearing a tie-dye dress every day for the rest of her life?
No, but it's true, though. She did. And for her afterlife.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, Hades is angry with her because she created the prophecy that caused all this
stuff.
She didn't
create it. She just interpreted it.
Right? But Hades can't kill her because the spirit of Delphi protects her. And Hades is like, well, I can't kill you, but I can curse you to an absolutely miserable existence. So Hades curses her to no longer be able to move as the spirit of Delphi from body to body, as the spirit has been doing this whole time. trapping the spirit inside a mortal body that will eventually wither and die. So the spirit is well alive inside a mummified body because of Hades. And he's like, as long as my children are outsiders, you shall be cursed to stay in this body. And like, it's not her fault. She literally just showed up.
Yeah.
Like, why did she even go to talk to Hades? He's the worst right now.
Yeah. I don't know why she decided that she needed to explain some actions to Hades right now.
She's send like, a letter. Don't mess with death, Hades. It's like, oh, he'll do whatever he wants. So the mist kind of fades. Like, the scene is over. And we see Nico again, and Hades is in front of him this time, wearing all his, like, black robes and a scowl, and he's like, what exactly are you doing? And Nico's just like,
the exact thing that you told me not to do?
Yep. YOLO, you need information? You gotta find a way to get it. So next we see Percy seeing Rachel. And Rachel is like on the beach in St. Thomas or wherever she is, writing in ancient Greek in the sand. And it's like, how does Rachel know ancient Greek?
She's just that good.
But he sees his own name in the sand, Perseus. His full name, his formal name, not even his.
What if she was writing a letter to Poseidon? Like, putting a message to Poseidon in the sand?
And she's like, no, I have to go formal because this is a god I'm talking to.
Yeah, this is a mortal addressing a god. You gotta go super formal.
Could be. And she's like, oh, gods, that's what it means. And, like, takes off back up the beach to the villa to talk to her dad, who's sitting on the porch reading the Wall Street Journal because he's that kind of guy. And she's like, Dad, we have to go back to New York City right now. Percy's in danger. And he's like, how do you know? Did he call you? And she's like, no, I just know.
He doesn't need to.
And her dad's like, we just got here. We spent a lot of money to take this vacation. And Rachel's like, you and Mom hate the beach. Like, why are we even here? Nobody likes it here. And he's like, whatever, Rachel. And she's like, look, I'll make you a deal. And he's like, I'm listening. And she,
I've read the art of the deal.
So Rachel makes a deal with her father that if he takes her back to New York City immediately, she will go to Clarion Ladies Academy in the fall, and she won't even complain about it.
Good for her.
Yeah, I'm like, ugh. It's not like he wasn't going to make her go anyway, though. You know, she's 15. If that's where he says she's going, that's where she's going.
Mm-hmm. But now she's going willingly.
Yeah, which makes him happy and Percy worried. He's like, no, Rachel. But he wakes to Talia.
I love the way that he reacts to her making a deal. She's just like, how dare you, can't make a deal with your dad. That's the most evil person in your life. It's like, but it is her dad. Like,
yeah. Regular mortals can make deals without swearing on the River Styx.
Yeah. And they can break deals without any bad things happening, really.
Yeah, that happens too. And so it's like, he is more unhappy about this deal than Rachel is, honestly. But Percy wakes up to Talia shaking him and telling him that they have visitors. And there's a Titan approaching under a flag of truce, bearing a message from Kronos. Dun dun dun.
Chapter 13. A Titan brings me a present.
5 stars.
4 stars.
What? We switched. I just thought it's like, it's Titans, which is cool. And they're bringing presents, which...
That's true.
What? And it just
sounds dangerous.
That's
all the reasons I gave it 4 stars. I just need it to be, if it was just like slightly funny, then it would be 5 stars.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was humorous. Because it's like, why would a Titan be bringing Percy a present?
I guess. I don't know. I need to, like, I don't know. I need to chuckle more when I read it.
All right. So, chapter 13, second chapter for this here episode.
This here episode.
So, it turns out that the visitors are a 30-foot-tall giant called a Hyperborean. And I love how it's like Talia recognizes what kind of giant he is. And she's like, there's a huge colony in Canada. Like, why are all the giants from Canada?
Just a space. They can spread out a little more there.
I guess so. There's a halfling in armor, a guy wearing a tux, and an impusa with flaming hair wearing a black evening gown. And they all meet at the Heckscher Playground, which I'm guessing is in Central Park somewhere. And yep. I love how Percy has his, like, team assembled around him, like his squad, you know? Because Talia and Grover are back, which is awesome. And Annabeth isn't able to be there, but she's there in spirit.
Yes.
She's probably watching from her terrace lounge.
Yeah. Or with her mirror, or what? Not with the mirror, with the shield.
Yeah, there you go. And Grover is like, he looks like a magician. I hate magicians. They usually have rabbits. Percy's like, you don't like bunnies? And Grover's like, they're so mean. They steal celery from unsuspecting satyrs. And Percy's like, we'll deal with your fear of bunnies later. We got other stuff to deal with right now.
We'll bring Jackson to him.
Like, yeah.
Jackson will take care of the bunnies.
Yeah. So the tux dude, as Percy calls him, has scars all over his face like he was attacked by a really, really mad hamster.
Yeah.
And he introduces himself as Prometheus, which should be a pretty familiar name for anyone who's heard of Greek mythology at all.
Even if not, if you've heard of Frankenstein, the original title was like Prometheus Bound?
Oh.
Or this, didn't know, I don't know. That. Yeah, Frankenstein was a Prometheus tale.
Oh, gotcha. And Ethan Nakamura is a half-blood who is with Prometheus. And Percy's, like, looking good because his nose is totally smashed in from the battle. And Ethan just, like, gives him a death glare. Percy's like, I'm not afraid of
you. You mean a death glare?
Yeah. Percy is not afraid of him at all. It's awesome. So apparently, Percy's like, aren't you the one who was tied to a rock and had your kidneys eaten out every day or something? And Prometheus is like, can we not talk about that? Hercules set me free eons ago. He's like, I've always had a soft spot for demigods.
Well, thanks.
I guess. So the giant starts crushing playground equipment, just like trying to play on it. And he's like, uh-oh, every time he crushes something. And
you were about to say that.
I was. He reminds Percy of Tyson, and Percy's like, oh, God, I hope I don't have to fight this guy, you know? But, Prometheus is a very interesting character, because he, like, seems kind and, like, genuinely concerned for their well-being. But he's still a Titan. And he's like, I am the Titan of forethought, Percy. And Grover's like, also the Titan of crafty counsel. Emphasis on the crafty. But he's like, he's such a good person to send for this parlay. Because he is like, he makes you feel all like, yeah, you're right. You do care about me. You did give us fire. You do have a soft spot for us. But in reality, he's still this Titan who's on Kronos' side, you know?
Yeah.
Ugh. He's like, he's the kind of guy who gives you, like, creepy crawlies.
We'll talk about this a little more in Oh My Gods, but it really surprises me that Prometheus is on Kronos' side. Because in the original Titan War, he was not. He was on the god side. But guess what? The gods did him dirty. So he's not anymore.
He also says that he has seen how this war turns out and he can you know, he knows who's going to win. And he's like, I know who to support, Percy Jackson. Don't you want to be on the side of the person who knows what's going to happen?
And but he's the god of forethought, not the god of prophecy. So this is just like, he's run the numbers and he thinks he knows who's going to win.
Yeah. It's like that's betting on the horse race just because you're friends with the horse jockey, the guy who owns the horse, you know? He's like, you know, it's like, well, Bill's horse has been doing all this training and he's got the best jockey in the 5-state region. So I'm going to bet on that one. But really, you don't actually have all the information.
But really, you're only betting on Bill's horse because you're friends with Bill and you've heard Bill complain about how much he's training this horse. But if you were friends with all the other jockeys and their owner and the horse owners, you'll be hear how much more the other horses are getting trained. And Bill's horse is actually just very lazy.
And you're mad at Sarah because she ripped you off and she's racing her horse, but you're mad at her. So you're not going to bet on her horse. You're going to bet on Bill's horse.
And you're going to like completely mess up your whole bet and you're going to lose all your money because you should have bet on Sarah and you didn't do your research.
You're trying to teach this other guy how to bet, but he knows about your whole fight with Sarah and your friendship with Bill, so you're having a real hard time convincing him.
I like that we're talking about this and we have no clue about any kind of horse racing.
It's a thing. People bet on it. Jockeys ride the horses and the races. What more do you need to know for this analogy?
Nothing.
Prometheus tries to convince Percy that the demigods are outnumbered, and he's seen the destruction of the demigod army in the future, and Percy is refighting the Trojan War, and Percy's like, are you gonna shove a wooden horse in the elevator in the Empire State Building? And he's the sass coming from Percy Jackson in this chapter is real.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Also from Annabeth. And Prometheus says that if Percy surrenders, if he and the demigods put down their arms, Kronos will be lenient and forgive the survivors. And he's like, you have already lost so many people. Surrender now, everybody else will survive. If you keep fighting, you're going to lose anyway and everyone will die. If you surrender, you'll lose, but not everyone will die. And Percy's like, no. But Prometheus gets under Talia's skin by calling her Talia Grace. And Talia's like, that's my mother's surname. I no longer use it. And Prometheus is like, as you wish. And Percy kind of thinks about it. He's like, I've never actually heard Talia's last name. So store that away.
I think that's so weird, though, because I swear I already knew Talia's last name. But I guess not. Maybe that's just because... other books.
We've read this book already.
No.
I did kind of think, I was like, are we sure that it was never said before? But I guess not. I guess he would know.
I guess not. Like it, now, I'm feeling, I don't think it has been. It's always just been Talia, the great girl in the tree, the girl from the tree, the girl who is a tree.
Spiky-haired daughter of Zeus turned hunter.
Her name is Talia. You need nothing more.
She's like Beyonce, baby. And somebody in their mind is stabbing me for comparing Talia to Beyonce.
We need a picture of Talia dressed up like Beyonce. Talia doing some like a lemonade thing.
Yeah,
that'd be fun.
And Talia's angry now, so she's like, you only gave humans fire to annoy the gods, Prometheus. Don't pretend that you did it to help us. And Prometheus is like, no, that's not true. I totally have helped to shape your nature. And he pulls out, he just like materializes this ball of clay and he like shapes it into this little doll thing. And it's like wandering around the table and it's got no eyes. So it's just like stumbling around. And Prometheus is like, I have helped shape you. I gave you fire. I did all these things. and I'm awesome and I love you guys, but here's what's going to happen if you don't surrender. And he smashes it into a little flat pancake. And Percy's just like, I guess I appreciate the demonstration. Seems unnecessary.
Yeah.
And here, oh my God, Quinn. I mean, oh my gods, Quinn. On the episode of the Half-Blood Report that we just did with Sam and Diego, we talked about how on Twitter, somebody had tweeted, hey, do you guys think that Calypso is Percy's biggest what if? And I was like, ew, no. I hate that whole part. It's stupid. And somebody had tweeted at me, I think that that scene is important because it shows to Percy that Titans can change and they're not all evil. And I was like, boom, because anyone who listens to this show knows how much I hated that chapter. Well, Prometheus mentions Calypso, and he's like, you trusted Calypso. Why can't you trust me? Not all Titans are bad. Calypso did nothing wrong, and still she was imprisoned on this island. How can you trust the gods, Percy? Can't you trust me? And I read that, and I was like, ugh! Because, I hated on that scene so much, and now it's coming back, and it's making sense, and it means something, and it, it made me want to go back and erase everything bad I said about it.
Cannot do that. That would be, like, a half of, probably remove half of an episode.
So, instead, let me just say, I'm sorry, Rick, for not trusting you.
And you apologize to Calypso.
Sorry, Calypso. But I defend myself because I didn't know. So, I was going on the information that I had at the moment.
Yes. And in the moment, it's a weird chapter.
Yes. A whole book ago, it was a dumb chapter. Now, it's coming back.
Yeah. It's nice to see, like, things that we did not appreciate come back and be, I don't know, not reworked, but just better. Just, it's worked into the story. That's what it is. It's not reworked. It's worked into.
Yeah, exactly. It's like given context and meaning beyond the immediate. Yeah. Percy says to Ethan, he's like, you must hate this. And Ethan's like, I don't know what you mean. And Percy's like, well, if I take this deal and we surrender, you won't be able to get revenge and kill all of the demigods. And Ethan's like, all I want is respect. And he's like, why should I go to your stupid camp and be shoved into the Hermes cabin with 17 other people just because you don't respect my mother? And honestly, like, I don't really blame him for this.
Point.
Yeah, like, all the unclaimed kids or the kids of minor gods just have to live in the Hermes cabin miserable just because they weren't lucky to be born to one of the top 12, you know? Like, it's BS. And Percy's like, oh, so your mother is the goddess of revenge. I'm supposed to respect the goddess of revenge now? And Ethan's like, she's also the goddess of balance.
Yeah.
Duh.
And Percy respects the god of the underworld, so why not respect the goddess of revenge? Or goddess of what does he say? Oh my god, vengeance.
Right? Yeah. Revenge, vengeance, whatever. But apparently, Nemesis has promised Ethan that he will tip the balance of power one day. And all he had to do was give up his eye as payment, you know?
Nice, thanks.
So you don't get nothing for free, my friends. And Percy's like, oh, so I saved your life in the labyrinth in the fight with Antaeus or whatever his name is. He's like, you repay me by raising Kronos. Nice. Thanks. And this whole time, Prometheus is just kind of, like, studying Percy's face. And Prometheus is like, what happened to Luke bothers you, but you don't know everything that happened. So I'm going to give you a vision.
So oh, thanks.
Yeah. Thanks, guy. You're the only one who's given me the whole story so far. And Percy finds himself in May Castellan's house, watching this scene unfold between Hermes and Luke, who are in the living room talking. And in the background, in the kitchen, he can see Talia, who's having her leg bandaged by May. And Annabeth is sitting beside Talia, playing with this little Medusa beanbag toy. And I was like, mm-hmm. Oh, that's such a cute, sad picture, because she's still only 7 years old.
She has a little toy Medusa.
Yeah, it's so sweet. And Hermes is wearing a blue jogging suit with Reebok sneakers with wings on them and looking upset again, which is like his permanent state at this point.
When dealing with Luke.
Yeah. And Luke is angry and he's asking Hermes why he decided to show up right now when they only went home back to May's house for help, you know? And he's mm-hmm. like, why are you here now when you haven't been here this whole time? And Luke says something disrespectful kind of about May. He's like, you left me with the crazy lady, essentially. And Hermes is like, you need to have some respect for your mother. He's like, I can't interfere with your path. Like, the gods aren't allowed to make big changes in the demigods' lives. And he's like,
especially their own children, it seems.
Yeah, yeah. And he's like, it's for your own good that I haven't been here and blah, blah, blah. And Luke's like, oh, was it just for my own good to be living on the streets, being chased by monsters and barely surviving? And Hermes is like, well, I know that you're capable of anything because you're my son. And when I was a baby, I crawled out of my crib. And Luke's like, I'm not a god. I'm just a kid.
It's like the kid is not the father. The kid is not the parent. Just because a parent is able to do something does not mean the kid is able to do something. Revolutionary thoughts.
Especially when that parent is a god and the kid is a demigod. Like,
if you heard a sneeze, that was Jackson.
Give him scratches for me. So it's a really stupid argument from Hermes's side. And yet Luke asks Hermes why he never helped Luke when May was having one of her fits and like shaking him, and he was hiding in the closet so that he wouldn't have to see, you know, his mother's eyes glowing green and her hissing and scaring him. And he's like, did you even care when I ran away? Did you care that I was scared? And Hermes is like, yes, I care. And meanwhile, in the background, this whole time, May is just like chattering to Talia and Annabeth and like pouring them Kool-Aid and telling them stories about Luke as this little kid. And Annabeth like holds up a burnt cookie and she's like, can we go now? And Luke's just like, not yet, apparently. So Hermes says to Luke, I care very much. And but he tells Luke that it is against the ancient laws for gods to intervene directly in mortal affairs. And then he says, especially if your destiny ... And Luke's like, what? My destiny what? Tell me what my destiny is. And Hermes is like, I can't. And he's like, you shouldn't have come home, but I see now that you're getting too old to just be running around with no help. And he's like, I'll have Chiron send a satyr to help you get to Camp Half-Blood. And that satyr was Grover. Mm-hmm. We love Grover.
Yeah.
And Luke's like, back up. Can we please talk about my destiny? Like, let's rewind back to that. And Hermes is just like staring at Luke. And Percy has this moment where he's like thinking that he realizes that Hermes knows what May Castellan's fits mean. And Hermes has known this whole time what will happen to Luke and hasn't been able to do anything about it. And Hermes is like, I must allow you to make your own path, even if it tears my heart. And Luke's like, you don't love me. And Hermes is like, I promise I do love you. Go to camp. I will see that you get a quest soon. You will get a chance to be a great hero before ... And Luke's like, if you love me, just tell me what is happening. Tell me what is going to happen to me. Tell me why you have
this. This is another case of keeping the person that the prophecy is about in the dark.
Yes. Hermes is just like, I cannot tell you. Like, I can't. And the whole time I was reading this, I was just thinking, like, this is so freaking sad.
Yeah.
Like, Luke, it's just so sad.
It is. It's because, like, he would not have returned to his mom's house if he didn't have to, let alone if he knew that he would have had to interact with his father. And now he's finally talking to his father, and I'm guessing this is, like, the first time they've actually met each other and talked, and it's not going in any way a good direction.
Yeah.
Which is sad.
It is, and Hermes, I believe Hermes when he says that he loves Luke and that he cares about him and that he would help him if he can, but it's like, if he does, the gods will probably kill Luke. Zeus probably will, and they'll punish Hermes, and it's just like, what is meant to be is meant to be, I guess. It's like,
because if Hermes knows what Luke is heading towards, do the other gods know as well? Like, because I feel like if the other gods knew, they would have just killed him.
I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe it's like a connection to his child thing.
Well, like, Zeus basically killed his own daughter thinking that she might cause the prophecy to unfurl.
He didn't kill her. He locked her into a tree.
Okay, sorry. How's this for a better example? Zeus decimated an entire hotel just by the small chance of maybe killing two of Hades' children. Yeah. And we're assuming that if he does not, or if he didn't, or if he knew that Luke would become like Kronos, and he knew that, and he didn't kill him. That's very un-Zeus-like.
It is, actually. That's a good point. I don't know. I just, there's so much like pain in their interaction, like from Hermes wanting to help and not being able to, and then Luke. You know, this is the first time he's interacted with his father, and he's 14 years old. And, it's just so sad. And
yeah, Luke is 14, and this is the first time that he's having a face-to-face with his dad.
Yeah.
No wonder he's messed up.
Yeah, and it's like, there's the people who are like Prometheus who argue Hermes could have helped him, he should have helped him. He didn't do everything that he could, but then there's like, it's against their laws to change things. Like, what would happen if the gods just went around willy-nilly interfering with mortals' lives? And it's like, if Luke were anyone not Hermes's child, Hermes wouldn't help, but because Luke is his child,
in fact, he probably would just kill him.
Yeah. Yeah, if nothing else, right? So it's like, it's just giving me the feels. So to top it all off, Luke yells at Hermes, then you don't care, when Hermes won't tell him. And Hermes is like, I am your father. And Luke's like, no, you're not. He's like, a father is supposed to be around. I've never even met you.
Yeah.
And he like turns away from Hermes, but Percy can see that he's trying not to cry. And Luke is like, all right, tell you, Annabeth, let's go. So they all run out the door, and May tries to follow them out, but Hermes stops her, and she starts having, like, a glowing green eyes episode and, like, hissing about, like, my son, his fate, destruction, blah, blah. And Hermes is just like, I know, my love, I know. Ugh, it's so sad. It's just a lot of sadness in these two chapters.
There is so much sadness.
Like, Nico and his mom, and
Luke
and Hermes and his mom. Ugh. This is the reason we're only doing two chapters this episode.
I know.
So, Percy comes back to the present, And he's still sitting at the picnic table with Prometheus and his squad. And Prometheus just is like, appalling, isn't it? And he's like, how long did it take them to tell you your prophecy, Percy? And Percy's like,
oh, my sir, I heard it last week.
I've known it for like 4 days, bro. Yeah. But that's what we've been saying this whole time. Mm-hmm. The people need the information. And Prometheus asks him, don't you think your father knows what will happen to you? And Perseus is just like, I do now.
Thanks for putting that thought in my head.
Lapro. And Grover's like, hey, Percy, he's just messing with your mind. He's trying to make you angry. And Grover can sense Percy's emotions, and Percy's like, it's working, Grover. It's working. And Prometheus is like, can you blame Luke for being angry? Like, do you really still want to fight these gods who don't care about you, don't help you? And Kronos is offering you peace and, you know, leniency and life. And
oh, he's offering us life. How exciting. That's
right. It's like Kronos isn't really offering them anything besides not to kill
the
them.
Bare minimum.
That's pretty the much on not death. Yeah. So Percy's like, okay, I have a deal. Kronos, call off his army, leave Luke Castellan's body, return to the pits of Tartarus, and then I won't destroy him.
Oh. Good
sounds
deal.
Like an even deal. And Prometheus is just like, tisk, tisk. And he gives Percy the gift, just in case he changes his mind. And this gift is a 3-foot-tall Greek vase with a black and white design, like fastened with leather. Yes. And Percy feels a vague sense of fear looking at it. And Talia and Grover recognize it as Pandora's box, even though it's not a box. It's a pithos, like you said. And it's kind of funny because Prometheus is like, I'm not sure how it became a box, but whatever.
Yeah.
So Pandora obviously opened the pithos, released illness, death, fear, hunger, and apparently the first Empusa, who is now Prometheus's permanent prom date. And Prometheus explains that the gods want the mortals to think that the lesson in the pithos is that humans shouldn't be so curious and have so many questions and wonder about things. But according to Prometheus...
No wondering.
Yeah. According to Prometheus, giving Pandora the pithos was actually a trap to punish the Titans and all of humanity along with them. And Prometheus's words are really getting to Percy's head. In the back of his mind, Percy is like thinking about Zeus destroying that entire hotel just to kill 2 people, Hades cursing the Oracle out of anger, Hermes abandoning Luke. You know, I'm sure his own father not giving him all the help that he probably could have. And he's like, how does this make the gods any better than the Titans, essentially?
Yeah. I don't... Not whisper. There aren't.
Yeah. The only difference is Kronos fights with monsters and kills mortals. And so Prometheus is like, well, there was only one spirit left in the pithos when Pandora opened it. And Percy's like, yeah, it was hope. Elpis, the spirit of hope, is still in the pithos and cannot leave it without being given permission by a child of man. So Prometheus like pushes the pithos toward Percy and tells him that if he decides he has seen enough destruction and he wants to signal that he's surrendering, then all he has to do is open the pithos and release Elpis, and Kronos will spare the demigod survivors. And Percy's like, I don't want this. I do not want this. Take it back. And Prometheus tells him that it's too late. The gift has been given. Cannot be taken back. And Prometheus is like, all right, come along, my parlay squad. And apparently the giant's name is Moraine. Just kind of
nice
funny.
Name for a giant.
Yeah. And Prometheus is like, we will see you soon, Percy Jackson, one way or another. And I like how he ends the chapter with them heading back the way they came into the sunset. Like, it's just a normal sunny Sunday afternoon. And it's like, oof.
Things gonna happen tonight.
Yeah. So much. Okay. These two chapters are sad.
There's only two chapters, and how long have we been talking?
A long time already.
I know.
So these chapters are sad, ominous.
Yes.
Depressing.
Check. They check all the boxes. Are you ready for Oh My Gods?
Oh My Gods!
There are no gods, so we're already done with Oh My God. Say goodbye. Like, we could talk about, like, Hades or, what's his name, Hermes or whatever.
We already talked about them.
We've already talked about them in other episodes. So if you want to do that, go back. Find, I don't know, go back. Welcome to Bring On The Monsters, man.
Yes. Bring on the monsters.
Yeah. So, we're going to be talking about Prometheus. And Prometheus could probably be in the Oh My Gods, but he sided with the Titans, which means he's going to be a monster now. Or whatever, in my mind. He's categorized now.
I accept it.
So, yeah. We're all pretty familiar with the Prometheus story. Just by reading this book, you would be pretty familiar with the Prometheus story. We already know he was punished by Zeus. He got his liver torn out by birds. He got his face all scratched up to make him look like a hamster. We already know a lot about Prometheus. But I'm going to give you a little extra, little something. Because when I read this story, I was like, wow, I didn't realize there was so much more to Prometheus' story. So, let me find my spot. Okay, so the Prometheus that Percy meets is, like, he sees the human world as a lost cause. He wouldn't mind turning things over to Kronos and turning things, everything up on its head in order to basically start anew. That which is, happens a lot in mythology in general. Just like, yeah, we're going to kill everybody and start the planet over again. It'll be fine. And Prometheus sort of just sees it. Yeah, it's another time for that. It's time for that to happen again. But he wasn't always like this. In fact, he was sort of like the original sort of speaker for humanity. He was humanity's first friend. And as humanity's first friend, he sacrificed everything for us. You could say he's sort of like Jesus. And he got like very little thank for it. Unlike Jesus. So before Prometheus was humanity's friend, he was Zeus's. And this is before humanity was even like a thing. He and Zeus were like BFFs. And this is the time after the first Titan War in which Prometheus fought against his fellow Titans and sided with his BFF Zeus. After the Titans War, like, the gods were sort of finding their foot, and all the gods were going around making babies and all that stuff. But when you're making babies, you're also growing babies, so a lot of things are happening. This is where we get, basically, all of the gods develop the things that we know them for today. So Athena, like, creates her owl in this time. Poseidon gets a dolphin. all of the gods start collecting pets and animals and creating animals for the world. Even Hades had a pet, and that was the three-headed dog that came. But Zeus was feeling a little left out. He was the king of the gods, after all. I almost said queen, and you know what? He is sort of the queen of the gods, too.
Whatevs.
But Zeus wanted a pet, and he's the king of the gods, so it better be a better pet than everybody else.
Right.
So he's sort of addressing these issues, or he's sort of thinking out that loud to Prometheus, his BFF, and he's just like, hey, what I'm thinking is we need another being. We need another class of beings that are lower than the gods and lower than the other lower deities, so like the nymphs and the dryads and all of those people. He wants it lower than that, but he wants it above the animals, so like pigs and owls and bears and all that. He wants a being that he can have a conversation with. He wants something with a consciousness. And Prometheus was like, I can do that. Because Prometheus was the titan of, basically he was crafty. He was crafty in every sense of the word. He could make things. And then also he sort of was a little sneaky sometimes. But then he also was the god of forethought, or whatever, titan of forethought. So he was also very good at planning. He was just sort of an all-around good guy. and Zeus was like, hey, I need to create a new creature. Would you be able to help me out? And Prometheus is like, I love crafts. I will do this for you, my friend. Give me, like, a dick.
I love crafts.
And some spit.
Pulls out his pipe cleaners and glitter. I love crafts!
Yes! And then he also gets out a little like bowl, and he's like, hey, Zeus, could you spit into this? It'll help me out. And Zeus is like, sure. So he gives Prometheus his spit. And the idea with the spit is that he's going to mold, he's going to form some beams out of clay, and that it'll be held together with Zeus's spit, so it'll have a little bit of divinity, and with that, some like free thought. I lost my spot again. Once Prometheus got this spit and he got his pipe cleaners and all of his glitter and crafting resources, he found a nice riverbank that has had really nice clay like soil. And he started to create. As I said, Prometheus was sort of the crafty titan. He was sort of the equivalent of Hephaestus in the titan sort of like pantheon. Just because instead of like creating more mechanized like inventions and like tools and beautiful things like Hephaestus does, he sort of makes all those things, but with a little more artistic flair. He's more casual, where Hephaestus is a professional maker, Prometheus is I make things for fun, but I'm still really good at it, and I'm still at the professional level, but I just don't make money for it. And so he was sort of like the perfect person to start crafting these people. And after a full day of laboring in the muddy, clay-filled riverbank, Prometheus had carefully shaped a colorful variety of life of masculine clay beings, because all of the beings that he makes are men, not because Prometheus only likes men, but because Zeus did not want women. He is like, if I get women up there, Hera will nix this entire project.
Well, he changed his mind on that one, didn't he?
He does. He eventually changes his mind. But his first plan did not include women, because he was very concerned that if they made more women, Zeus knows himself that he would not be able to resist. And he also knows his wife, and he knows Hera would be very angry. So Prometheus has made, after a day of laboring, he made like awesome, beautiful masculine figures, and he is made the first being he shaped, Prometheus tried to match its skin color to the sun-kissed complexions of the gods, and then he was sort of just like, all right, now I'm gonna be creative. So next he made one with in a shining black color. Then he made one that was more ivory cream color tinged with pink. Then this is when sort of Prometheus sort of hits a roll and is like, yeah, I don't need to just do like a few colors. I'm going to do crazy colors, friends. So this is when Prometheus starts sort of like hitting the ground running and he starts making it. There's an amber shade person. There's a yellow person, a brown person, a red person, a green person, a beige person, a purple person, and of course, a blue person, because you can't not have a blue person. So after a full day of sculpting, Prometheus stepped away and he observed his work and he was like, gorgeous, amazing, awesome. We're going to let these bake. So he left them on the riverbed bank, and over the like hot sunny day or the afternoon or over the high sun of the afternoon, so Apollo baked the clay. So nice, get them nice and hard. But he had it timed out. So Zeus is going to come in around dusk. So the creations will be hot. They will basically be hard, but they will still be a little bit moldable just in case Zeus comes in, considering he's the commissioner of the work, and says, hey, I love your work, but I think it needs some longer ears, a few more legs, maybe an extra genital or two. He's leaving in some room for Zeus's suggestions at last minute. And so, soon enough, the end of the day came. And next thing you know, Prometheus sitting on the riverbank can hear some voices in the distance in the woods next to the riverbank. And he can tell that Zeus is there, but he's also brought someone along. He's brought his favorite child, Athena.
Nice.
Prometheus is hearing Zeus like rumbling through the woods, like, I can't find the river. Where's the river? I was just here this morning. And Athena's like, Dad, I think it's this way. We were just above it. We could see. Why are you lost right now? And next thing you know, before Prometheus could yell out and say, stop, be careful, Zeus plows into the riverbank and steps on a row of figures.
Tisk, tisk.
Tisk, tisk, tisk. And thus, we do not have purple or blue or green people.
How do you know? Have you seen them?
No, I haven't. Oh my god! Prometheus was a little upset, like, dude, you just destroyed three of my figures. I spent all day making these things. This is, like, hard work. I thought these were beautiful. Those were my favorite ones. I spent a half hour mixing that perfect shade of blue, but fine, you just stepped on them. Guess it doesn't matter. So Zeus completely destroyed these things. And before, like, Prometheus really started to freak out on Zeus, like, because Prometheus was one of the only people that could yell at Zeus without getting, like, killed all right away, because Zeus and Prometheus are BFFs, and you can yell at a BFF. And Athena looked at the still intact figures laying on the ground in the sun, in the light of the dying sun, and she just, like, was like, oh my God, they're like glowing in this light. They're absolutely beautiful. Prometheus, they're perfect. And all the anger that was growing inside of Prometheus just disappeared because praise from Athena meant everything. So Athena was there in order to breathe life into these clay figures, to make them sculpted by a Titan and then formed from Gaia's clay, held together by Zeus's spit, baked in the sun, Apollo, and then brought to life by the goddess of wisdom. send breathing life into the clay, literally inspiring them. So, like, Athena is literally inspiring them. She's, like, breathing into perspire, inspire.
I get it. I get it.
Yeah. She's literally inspiring them with some of her own qualities of wisdom, instinct, craft, and sense.
Gotta get that sense.
And before long, all of these figures were started to stirring, and they're like twitching and wiggling and crawling and walking, and then one of them coughed, and then another one grunted, and another one screamed, and another one went, ah! And then, and then they started figuring out how to like form words, and they're chattering among each other, but then one of them looked up, and he saw three giant figures watching them and going, yay! And these little guys were terrified because there's three giants smiling at them and just like there. Why are there giants?
Yeah.
So the little guys started just like running around frantic, and Zeus and Athena were just like, whoa, why are we freaking these guys out? And Prometheus like, oh, we're just too big. We need to shrink down. And so Prometheus is the first one who shrunk down to the humans level. And then Zeus and Athena were like, I guess we should do that too. Get eye to eye. So all the gods shrunk down to actual, like, conversation level with these guys. And they immediately, like, just, like, with hugs and smiles and gentle words, these frightened beings were, like, pacified, and they became friends, and everyone was happy again. And the beings started like clustering around the immortals and bowing and prostrating themselves. And Prometheus is like, whoa, no need to bow. Like, he's like lifting them up. And he kept grabbing them and picking them up. Like, stop bowing, I'm your friend. And Zeus was like, excuse you, Prometheus. They have every reason to bow. We are their gods. Like, and Prometheus was like, whoa, friend. I am not their god. I am their friend. I want to teach them how to farm and how to mill wheat and rye and how to cook and forge tools. And as Prometheus continued like listing all the things that he's going to teach these little guys, Zeus's face just starts growing redder and redder with anger. He's like freaking Vernon Dursley. And he just burst, and he's just like, no, you can befriend them, yes. And I am sure that Athena and the other gods will do the same. But there is one thing that they cannot have ever, and that is fire. With fire, they could rise up against the gods. With fire, they could think that they are equal with the gods. They must never have fire. I, Zeus, have spoken. And as a period to that statement, a roll of thunder echoed above. But everything on Earth is here for them to enjoy. They just can't have fire. And like, he's fine with like Demeter coming down and teaching them how to like farm and stuff, but they're not allowed to cook. Why are you cooking? No.
Yeah. Rare steaks only.
Yeah. And Prometheus didn't agree with this new decree, but he also, with his forethought, knew that this is not the time to speak up against the king of the gods. So Athena, being always practical, was sort of just like one sitting there, like sort of peeked up after Zeus was done ranting, and she was like, but what should we even call these guys? And after some thought, Zeus declared, that is which below. What? That is which below. That witch is below. That witch is below. Sorry. Anthropos. Which, if you look at the translation, it directly means like human. So like, but like specifically the male part of it. There were no females, so no, Anthropos, just the men.
Convenient.
Yeah. And it upset Prometheus that he'd only been able to make male people because he felt that the single-sex clone race lacked the variety and character that with the inability to breed. And that meant that there were no new types of people. So, like, he couldn't have an orange person. Like, the red person and the yellow person couldn't have a baby and have an orange person. He was really upset about that. And the humans were, like, really happy, yeah, because they were leaving such an unchallenging and unchallenged life that they lack sort of, like, the zest for life. They needed something. They needed that fire. They needed that, with fire, they could melt, smelt, roast, toast, boil, broil, and forge. They needed an inner fire to a divine fire. That's even better. Which would allow them to think, imagine, dare, and of course, do. And Prometheus knew just where to find such fire. So one night, after a great feast on Olympus, and everybody was sort of like, I don't know, in a food coma, and their houses on Olympus, Prometheus saw his chance, and he took it. Literally. Taking a long stalk of some flammable wheat, which is every wheat, Prometheus snuck into Hephaestus's forge, where a sleeping Cyclops was on guard, and stuck his stick into the forge before the Cyclops could wake up in order to get some of that divine fire. And then while he was, and then he, like, really quickly, as soon as that stick lit on fire, he turned around and ran away. But when Prometheus turned with his stick of flame, an ember hit the Cyclops in the face. And it woke him up, but not, like, fully, like, not fast enough to catch Prometheus in the act. He sort of was able to see Prometheus walk away, and he was, like, able to identify, that's Prometheus, but he wasn't able to, like, get up and, like, chase after him and get the flame. So that's how the gods as a whole end up finding out that it's Prometheus, he accidentally woke up this Cyclops that was on the guard. Prometheus just ran out the room with his little stick of flame and started climbing down the mountain back to his little human settlement that he and his brother decided to make their homes. And so he brought fire to humanity and such, and, like, started, like, humanity immediately started to grow, and, like, then he started traveling around throughout all of the human settlements, bringing fire to every settlement, teaching them new crafts, new methods of doing stuff, all that jazz, new knowledge. And you might think this is sort of where the story ends for Prometheus. You might think this is when, all right, he brings fire to the humans, and then Zeus finds out and punishes him by feeding him into the birds or whatever. But it's not that simple. He doesn't do that right away. Zeus sort of does a slow burn, get it, for Prometheus. There's punishments upon punishments upon punishments. Many, many, many people are punished for one person's actions. And sort of, I want to sort of just continue the story until we get some female into the humanity people. And that still is involved with the Prometheus. So Prometheus, while he was out, once a fire came to humanity, he started just traveling all over humanity and giving fire everywhere. And while he was doing that, his brother was stuck at home, and he was happy with that. He's a little homebody. But Epimetheus is stuck at home, but before Prometheus left Epimetheus, he said, hey, the gods are going to do something. I can tell with my forethought that Zeus is planning something. Whatever you do while I'm gone, do not accept any gifts from the gods. One rule. Don't accept any gifts from the gods. Now, guess what he does?
He accepts a gift.
He does. And that gift happened to be the first woman, Pandora.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So Pandora was shaped from the from clay, just like all the rest of humanity. But instead of Prometheus doing the shaping, it was Hephaestus. And it was a request of Zeus, as always. But it was sort of a, like, we're going to trap him with this woman. So it's a honey trap. Ha. So Hephaestus makes Pandora, and he sort of designs her after, like, all of the goddesses, because those are the women on hand. So they introduce Pandora to Epimetheus, and Epimetheus is just like, this is the most beautiful person I've ever seen, because this is the first person that he's seen that's actually in his league, not the goddess. But yeah, I'm sure she was also very, very beautiful. And Pandora was also gifted a wedding present, because Epimetheus and Pandora got married, and her wedding present from the gods was Pandora's pithos, or Pandora's jar, or Pandora's box. And I looked it up, because I remember hearing it, you can trace it back to a specific historian of why it's called Pandora's box now, and that we can blame on Erasmus, a 16th century humanist who mistranslated the story of Pandora and translated pithos as box. So, boo on you, Erasmus. What else did you do?
Tisk, tisk.
And Pandora caused a lot more drama, and I'm not going to get into the whole details of Pandora's story, but basically, she caused a lot of drama, and she caused it so humanity is now going to die and get sick, and we have murder and just be bad. But she also had kids, which meant there were more women, which meant that the humanity as a thing could continue on.
Nice, I guess.
Yeah. But what is sort of fun is, so if you look at just like mythology, like origin stories, in nearly every mythology, whatever, from all over the world, there's always a period where there's a great flood. And Pandora and Epimetheus, I believe it's like their son and maybe a dog. I don't know. I don't remember. Like only one descendant down. They end up becoming basically the Noah. They're these two descendants of Pandora or whatever. Become the last remaining survivors of a great flood that Zeus puts down on the world. Also a part of his punishment to Prometheus. So,
oh my god, Zeus, come on.
Yeah. He just kept punishing Prometheus, even when Prometheus was not the one getting directly affected. But he's like, also,
Prometheus loves these people, I shall kill them all.
Yeah.
Zeus sucks.
Yes, he does. But Prometheus was humanity's first friend, and he ensured that humans would thrive and grow, and all while knowing it, or wait, he ensured that humans would thrive and grow, all while knowingly putting himself on Zeus's blacklist, and just, Prometheus was the titan of forethought. Meaning he's very good at plans and figuring out other people's plans, but he's not the god of prophecies. He's not the titan of prophecies. He doesn't know these things that he thinks are going to happen do not necessarily happen.
Yeah.
And yeah. Prometheus, a complicated character.
He's very interesting.
He is. It's a very interesting story. I definitely did not realize that he was the one who formed us. And I'm yes. really sort of sad that Zeus stepped on a blue person. I would like to see a big blue
Gosh,
person.
Darn it. Speaking of blue people.
Yeah, we get the hypo... Wait, Hyperborean giants.
Hyperborean.
Hyperborean giants. Not to be confused with the Lastergorian, or wait, Lastergonian giants. Also fellow right. Canadians, but those guys are cannibal Canadians, and yeah. These guys are nice Canadians.
Fire Canadians, snow Canadians, only two kinds.
So inland to the north, perhaps you are picturing Canada because Percy Jackson mentioned Canada's. But I am talking ancient times, so don't think Canada. We're going north of Thrace, which in modern times would take us north of the Arctic Circle. So, cool. In this land of frozen tundra is a small oasis. And this is Hyperborea. Oh! A land blessed by Apollo with sunlight for 24 hours a day. The people here are giants, and they never age or get sick, and they don't need to work or fight or in any wars or battles. And within its community of happy giants, there were the Hyperboreads. Wait, is that how you say that?
Sure.
Hyperboreads. Yeah. Hyperboreads, who served as immortal priests to the tribe. So, hurrah. And the Hyperboreads is where the name Hyperborean comes from. Yeah. And they were three giant sons of Boreas, the god of the north wind, and Keone, the goddess of snow. And why, yes, Boreas and Keone are father-daughter, but don't think of that.
Think about all that.
Things and it's so it doesn't even matter. but the Hyperboreads served as immortal priests to the Hyperborean tribe, and the Hyperborean tribe themselves were already giant, blue, awesome people who were just really nice. And and that's basically in myth, it's sort of just referred to as, hey, north of Thrace, there's this kingdom of giants that they're all really nice.
they're happy.
Yeah. And then because the land was blessed by Apollo, and it was also believed that Apollo might live there or at least live there part-time. There was also a lot of sons of Apollo or like healers. So come out of that area. So yeah. Apollo's area.
It's Apollo's vacation home.
Yeah. To the north. I saw when I was looking this up, it's very easy to go into an Atlantis wormhole when looking at the Hyperboreans.
Nice.
Because it's considered the Atlantis of the North, and there are many people who are trying to find the real Hyperborea.
Interesting.
Yeah. No, every time someone finds like a giant bone, they're like, look, the giants. And like, yeah, it's a giant.
That's funny.
But are you ready for quest queries?
Yes.
Good, because that's where we're at now.
Yeah, Will Solace and Travis Stoll. I don't know about that one.
I don't know. I don't think there's anything to back it up other than just a two-line conversation that refers to nothing. but I like to picture Travis is just really into stealing stuff for the people that he loves, and he really wants to steal medical supplies for Will. Love him.
Okay. Children of Hades, fatal flaw, holding grudges, hyphen Hitler.
Okay, so Bianca says, or warns Nico, that children of Hades always have the fatal flaw, or mostly have the fatal flaw, of holding grudges. And just looking back at the children of Hades that we know for sure are children of Hades, I can confirm. So Hitler, yeah?
Yeah.
You think he holds grudges?
Yeah, probably.
Probably those the art teacher that like said his painting sucks.
Yeah.
I shall kill all of you. You don't like my painting. Oh no.
Yeah, is that how that went? Is that how that happened?
Yeah.
Aye. So what's your question?
I don't know. I just sort of wrote it down and I was like, I'll think of a question.
All right. So that brings us to the end of this episode.
So you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at floor_600.
And Tumblr at floor600podcast.
You can email us at floor600.podcast@gmail.com and we will probably talk about you on an episode.
Yes. Join our Patreon at patreon.com/floor600 to help us to improve this podcast and get some cool stuff. Check out the Baby Centaur stickers and other stickers at a Redbubble shop at redbubble.com/people/floor600/shop, or just go on there and search Floor 600 Podcast. Probably easier, honestly.
And then check out the Half-Blood Report for our episode, because
yes,
it's fun.
It's funny.
At least we had fun, so.
Yes.
You don't have fun. I don't know what to do with you.
Somebody on Twitter said that it was a very funny episode. So take that person's advice. And as always, rate, review, subscribe. We see all of your ratings, your reviews, your notes. We love it. And thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.